Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Eat, Sleep, Suplex, Retweet.
Hello and welcome to Eat, Sleep, Self-Isolation, Retweet. I am Toilet Roll Ross, he is Disinfectant White Wilson, and we are here to stockpile by some Ross's retro reviews.
Jesus, that is a quarantine intro, that. Too long in self-isolation.
I know. I've only been in isolation since Sunday as well. What's it going to be like when I do some tomorrow with Strack and David?
Oh, Jesus, Strack's been in isolation for God knows how long with his parent.
You're of course listening to us on Suplex Retweet Extra on either iTunes, Android or Spotify, but you can also use those platforms to catch our main channel, Eat Sleep Suplex Retweet, for all our interviews and our main weekly shows. And of course, if you want to find us on social media, at Suplex Retweet is your place to go on all the major sites, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube. So on the first of many retro reviews I'm going to record this week in self-isolation, we're going to be looking at SummerSlam 2000. It's the 13th annual SummerSlam event from Raleigh Entertainment and Sports Arena from Raleigh, North Carolina, filmed on August 27th, 2000. Stephen, what, just before we get into this, what did you make of this SummerSlam as a whole?
It's pretty much a SummerSlam. It's largely forgettable, bar a couple of exceptions that we'll kind of talk about later on. But when re-watching this one, I think it was like the first maybe two, three matches, watching it going, I forgot that was on this card. I forgot that even happened.
Yeah.
That forgettable to start with.
What we're going to do here on the retro review, because we are recording a few over a few days and we're going to stockpile and release them for you just so you've got something to do during quarantine, aren't we lovely? We're going to do a wee different format here. We're going to have 10 minutes on the rest of the card, and then we're going to pick the five big matches on the card and just break them down in individual bits. So let's just jump right into the rest section here. And as you mentioned, a largely forgettable card, the first two or three matches. We opened the show with The Right to Censor versus Too Cool. We had Stevie Richards, The Good Father, and Bill Buchanan, Big Barry, a podcast favourite, against Rikishi, Grandmaster Sexy, and Scotty Too Hottie, who were accompanied by Godfather's former hoes. Stephen, did you notice that one of the hoes was Victoria?
Future. I did. Yeah, I did, and I noticed that. I didn't realise that our whole name was also Victoria. So, there we go. That was a nice bit of information I was given there by Mr. Jerry the King Lawler.
Her whole name's Victoria and she just kind of kept it.
I seen her and I was like, oh, that's Victoria. And he went, ah, here's Victoria, the ex-head ho. I'm like, oh, what creative from WWE, even in that point.
Exactly. Something I liked about the setup to this match was, you know, if in modern day WWE you had a heel like, say, Curtis Axel go up against a face like Cedric Alexander, you know, the lower card guys, no one would really care. But it's amazing how over Too Cool were for being like the lower card comedy act. Oh, and how hated The Right to Censor were.
The thing of The Right to Censor, you hated them from the minute, because that entrance theme was so irritating. And then they come out with those blooming Stevie Richards, especially with the short sleeve shirt. Who wears a short sleeve shirt and a tie?
That is only a George Asda three pack. But yeah, Too Cool. We always talk about them on this pod, and you know, every retro review so far I've mentioned it, and it shocks me every time. Just when you hear that beat drop, the pop from the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Aye, they were so over back then, and it's amazing. This was the last pay per view they were together in this, because obviously Rikishi would do it for The Rock at the next pay per view, pretty much, and then Too Cool will be no more. So it's crazy to think that we split them up, given how over they were.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as we end this, The Right to Censor win with a Stevie kick to Scotty Too Hottie.
It's a bit near him with the kick though. The kick's absolutely well off.
I know, it was a breeze of a kick. It was, I mean, the intent was there, let's just say that. Too Cool have been on, and so far during the retro report, the review, sorry, they've had 3 6-man tag team matches. They've been 3-0 so far, so this is the first time Too Cool have lost all 3 of them in a 6-man tag match. And considering the Right to Censor went on a sort of tear of the undercard up until like WrestleMania 17, I think this was the right decision. This kind of set them on their way.
Yeah, especially if, as I said, they were going to turn Rikishi anyway. There was no point giving Too Cool a win.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So speaking of things we forgot were on this card, X-Pac versus Road Dogg.
I forgot these two had a feud at this point.
Yeah.
It's so confusing.
It's so forgettable. So I remember this is round about when I started watching WWF regularly, watching SmackDown on Sky One on a Saturday morning. And the sort of thing I missed, before I realised we could take the pay-per-views, I missed Fully Loaded and I missed SummerSlam. So when SummerSlam came and gone, they just never mentioned Road Dogg again. They just kind of forgot about it. X-Pac was just on his own feuding with Chris Jericho. It's just such a forgettable feud, such a crap match.
There's nothing good about it. I mean, the reason why they were feuding, I mean, it's like the worst table spot ever from Road Dogg on the Raw. Was it Road Dogg or X-Pac? I can't even remember. It was that bad.
Like headbutts Road Dogg, and Road Dogg feels the need to dive as if he's been shot through a table.
This is the first time I think I genuinely think we had the X-Pac heat, as they call it now.
Yes.
The crowd absolutely stank on him. They just did not want him anywhere near that.
Yeah, every time X-Pac is doing something, the crowd are booing, they're shouting X-Pac sucks, they're chanting this is boring. See, as soon as Road Dogg gets like a punch in, the crowd go wild, and it's not because Road Dogg's over, it's because X-Pac's just that hated.
I don't know if I've just like been missing something all these years, but rewatching this, it was the first time I actually realised that Road Dogg had 69 in the back of his top. I've completely missed that all these years.
See, I'm kind of glad this match happened though, because see, after WrestleMania like 15, where they had Billy Gunn and Road Dogg as singles competitors, and then they had like a China, Road Dogg, X-Pac and Bill fighting over DX name. DX was just watered down so much. Like DX when it started in 97 with Shawn Michaels, China, Triple H, Rick Rude, DX in 98 when they're feuding with the Nation of Domination, and DX leading up to WrestleMania 15, great. But then after this, it's sort of like they break up, they fight over the name, they join the corporation, they fight with the McMahons, but now the McMahons are the faces and DX are the heels. Then they become part of the McMahon-Helmsley faction. Then Billy Gunn gets injured, so they just kind of throw X-Pac in with Road Dogg as a tag team. And I think they're a team that benefit greatly from like rose-tinted glasses, I think. They had a good maybe 18 months as a faction, but as an overall faction, I don't think they're as good or anywhere near the impact that the NWO had, because that's always like the comparison round about this era.
Yeah, I think they were I think the idea of bringing them back at this point, late 99 to 2000, was to kind of give Triple H some heavy hitters with this whole McMahon-Helmsley faction, but instead of doing something fresh, he just recycled the guys he previously had. And
yeah,
it didn't really do much for any of the other guys other than Triple H.
You know, absolutely. This is an awful match. X-Pac gets a low blow and gets the win. X-Pac tries to say, we're still the greatest tag team in the world. Road Dogg then stands up, low blows X-Pac, hits him with a pump handle slam. And this will be the last appearance on the podcast of Road Dogg with any sort of DX memorabilia on. He doesn't resurface until Survivor Series, where he's Rowdy Road Dogg and he's teaming with K-Quick.
Whatever happened to him?
I think about him 24/7. Moving on to a match that was forgettable but actually quite good. A good attraction match. China and Eddie Guerrero versus Val Venis and Trish Stratus.
I love Latino Heat. Oh, I forgot how much I love Latino Heat gimmick of Eddie Guerrero. It's so, he does such a great job with it.
See, something that, like, I personally, in the Attitude Era and everyone switching titles quite quickly, I never really had a favourite European champion. And see, since we've started the retro review, Eddie Guerrero by far is my favourite European champion. He had a 4-month reign. He had matches against Chris Jericho, Ese Rios, all three, a triple threat match with Dean Malenko and Perry Saturn, and then an actual really good match with Perry Saturn when he dropped the title at Fully Loaded. All four matches, like on pay-per-view, his title defences were great. Val Venis is coming off an iconic cage match with Rikishi, and it's just such a good match. It's such a fun match as well, and it's Val starting to get a bit of personality other than the whole porn star thing with Trish as his manager, and Eddie and China just being over as anything.
See, I never really got him at this point. I always remember this when him being just put in with Trish, and it was just like, I don't really get where they went with it. Obviously, the porn star gimmick had a shelf life, and the shelf life was over. Yeah. But it's quite perplexing that this was just kind of like they did this, and then he went to the Right to Censor stuff.
Yeah.
I think if they just went straight from porn star to Right to Censor, that would have been a better transition than having this stopgap in the middle.
Yeah, no, that is a weird one. I do agree with you. It is a good attraction match. Not much more to say really about the in-ring action. I think Eddie was the obvious winner heading into the match. Mm-hmm. But having China pin Trish to get the title was a good swerve, and it was also a good way to sort of end the sort of Val-Trish alliance.
I think it's kind of just a starting point for stuff that you'll obviously talk about in your later reviews, Ross. Because obviously this stuff with Eddie and China takes various different moves as we go along in the month, but no, it was a nice, it was a fun match, and at that point Trish was a heel that you kind of just, that heel manager you wanted to see get battered, and there was no better woman to batter than China.
Yeah, exactly. So we have Jerry Lawler versus Taz. We're going to talk about it on the Fully Loaded review. Taz cost Rikishi the Intercontinental title. It looks as if he's setting up with a feud with Rikishi. He's been attacking people at random, the likes of, you know, Crash Holly, Al Snow, who he has a match with it Fully Loaded. And then he starts to try target JR, because JR's very vocal of, like, he's not a fan of Taz's actions, which leads to Jerry Lawler coming out of, like, semi-retirement. And it's a weird one. Like, you really wouldn't expect Jerry Lawler to be the guy to go up against him, but this was actually a pretty good match, I thought, for what it was.
I thought the video package they did for this one, actually, I thought it was actually really good. They put a lot of time into it. It's something that WWE are quite guilty of nowadays. They don't really put the same effort into the lower card feuds like this, but they made a good bit about it. There's not really much to say about it. I kind of felt like for about a 6-year period, they kind of went to this match between these two quite a lot over time.
Yeah. Obviously, they have another one next month at Unforgiven. Then there's
one of One Night Stand or something like that. One of the One Night Stands.
Yeah. One of the one nights, because Taz sort of quietly retires. He goes into semi-retirement. He starts doing SmackDown. He retires fully, I think, mid-2001. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you see, when the brand warfare starts sets in, you always have them, like, threatening each other. Like, Taz is threatening Lawler, Lawler's threatening Taz. They never really come to blows, but there's always that tension there. And then, obviously, they go to the well with it again at One Night Stand. But for what it was, and as you said, the video package, I thought it was quite good.
It's a good finish.
I like how Taz is going to win the match. We see in the promo leading up to it that Taz locks JR in his car and smashes the window and gets glass in JR's eye. So JR in retaliation, as Taz got as the Taz mission on Jerry Lawler, picks up a jar of sweeties and smashes it over Taz's face. Jerry Lawler gets the old-fashioned heel pin, much to the delight of the crowd, as you see Taz writhing in pain, going, "The son of a bitch got glass in my eye. Son of a bitch got glass in my eye."
It was a homage to WrestleMania 2000 with the jar over the head.
And the final match, the wrestling classic. I'm gutted we have to put this in the rest section. It's the first ever stink face match. The Cat with Al Snow versus Terry with Perry Saturn.
It's bad, man. It's bad. Even for Attitude Era, it's bad.
Yeah. I mentioned how Eddie Guerrero's my favourite European champion. Perry Saturn's beat him for said title. This is what Perry Saturn's doing 3 weeks after beating Eddie Guerrero.
It's just that, see, if you kind of take away the gimmick of the match, it is just crap. The two of them, they use the Cat so much over the year 2000. She's literally like everywhere on every angle. She's at a prominent part in the Right to Censor stuff later on in the year, but she sucks in the ring, man.
This is the third match I've had to review with these guys, and I'm so glad that this is going to be the format going forward where I don't have to talk about these matches as much. We can just go, it was awful. The Cat wins, she stink faces Terry. The best parts of the match are when Al Snow hits Perry Saturn with a head, and that's about it.
Yeah, it's bad. There's no point even talking about it. It sucks.
Yeah. So we'll dive straight in. Our first of five matches we're going to talk about. Steve Blackman versus Shane McMahon for the hardcore title. The 24/7 rule was suspended by Mick Foley so that Shane couldn't drop the title to someone else to get them to fight Blackman. He was going to be forced to fight him. I like the lead up to this. We see twice that Shane is trying to get interviewed, and twice Steve Blackman's following him about, banging a kendo stick off a bin, going, "Let's go, son, let's go."
He's an intimidating guy, Steve Blackman. Just doing his gimmick and that type of stuff. So he plays it really well. He does the straight man really well.
Yeah, he doesn't like. The line I liked off King on commentary was, "Steve Blackman couldn't crack a smile if his life depended on it."
It's see this match. I think see the hardcore title. See, as much as it had all the great memorable moments with Crash and all that time, probably earlier on in the year, see, in this whole period of time, there's only really three hardcore title matches that people would go out and go, I really remember that. You've got the one at WrestleMania 2000 because of the style of the match. You've got the one at WrestleMania 17 with Kane, Big Show and Raven. Mm-hmm. And you've got this match. I think these are the only three matches in the hardcore title history that you actually remember the match as opposed to the actual moments.
Yeah, because there's a scramble at Backlash, a six-man scramble match at Backlash for the title, and there is a scramble at the next month at Unforgiven, but they don't really stick out. They just kind of seem a bit clunky. They seem a bit done because we've seen the one at WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Shane plays the part really well throughout this whole match. I love the exchange at the start with the kendo stick throwing. They just chuck it back and forward. So great hands from the two of them to catch that so many times.
I like the promo leading up to this match. You know, the promo we see that Blackman's fighting Test for the title. Albert comes out, Edge, Christian come out. You know, Blackman looks a total badass. He's just beating off all these sort of underlings. And then Shane looks like the cowardly heel because he comes in and steals the victory. And it's made Blackman look like an absolute killing machine. And it's made Shane McMahon look like what he should be. He shouldn't be, you know, the guy we've seen wrestling for 2016 to 2018. He shouldn't be the best wrestler in the world. He should be, you know, the cowardly heel, the guy who's only there because he's daddy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I liked the ring gear he had with, like, the champ written on the back of it and all that. You know, it plays up the arrogant dickhead.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that you mentioned about Blackman looked like a badass as well. If you, I remember when Blackman made his return the year prior, just around about the King of the Ring time, where pretty much was Vince's hired gun against Ken Shamrock. And he looked proper badass to start with, but then after he lost the feud to Shamrock, he kind of just floated away. He did the head cheese stuff with Al Snow, which was okay for what it was, but it wasn't really him. This kind of, they could have maybe done something with him after this match, but he kind of, this kind of, this is probably the last big moment for Steve Blackman's WWE career.
Yeah, he doesn't really do much after this, and he sort of just fades in and out a good bit, which is a shame, because the sort of character, the Lethal Weapon, I think Vince has a history of not liking guys with like real life backgrounds, which is ironic considering he's got Brock Lesnar as his WWE champion nowadays. And I mean, you know, Brock Lesnar got to be in WWE for at least the next 5 years, so you know, people could be listening to this retro review 4 years from now, you know what I mean, heading into WrestleMania 40 and Brock Lesnar's still the WWE champion. So
like, I'm surprised he never gave Dan Severn a chance with that beautiful grey shirt.
Oh, that beautiful. So, I'm sure that sweaty grey shirt was passed down to Luke Harper when he was in the Wyatt family.
That probably would have surprised me.
But just Blackman, it's a shame he just sort of fades away, as you say. And something, you know, we need to talk about the finish of the match. You know, we have Blackman beating Elliot Shane, you know, all over the arena, then Tess and Albert come out. Blackman managed just to fight them off. Shane climbs that structure up the side of the Titantron, and this is what this match is most known for. Blackman chases him up, hits him with a kendo stick, and then you just see Shane lose his balance and bang, 50 feet from the top of the Titantron through the definitely not a crash mat below.
Oh, it's an insane spot. I think it's the first big Shane McMahon spot that he's became known for over the years.
Yeah, yeah, because he always has to jump off something. Because I believe he had one against Big Show at Backlash. He jumps off the thing, but he does it like of his own accord.
I couldn't remember what pay per view it was. Was it the next? Was it the year after?
I think it, no. I should know. I do these fucking things. They all just merge together because I've done that many.
I do know. I know the spot you're talking about. Does the elbow drop off the top? Like the Big Show, I do remember the spot. I was thinking in my head, I was like, when was that match? I can't remember.
Do you
exactly
know what
it was?
I've just remembered he has a Last Man Standing match at Backlash 2000 with the Big Show, but then he has one at Backlash 2001, and that's when he does the big elbow drop. So yeah, you're right. This is Shane's first big spot.
Because the Backlash 2000 Big Show was doing those gimmicks when he was pretending to be everybody.
Yeah, yeah. But it's Judgment Day, sorry. You know what I mean? Like, these things just merge together when you do that many of them.
Totally, but no, it's a crazy spot. It's especially the fact that he just goes backwards. It's not like he's diving forward. He just literally just falls back and just hopes that he's going to land when he's meant to land.
Yeah, him and Jeff Hardy, I think, are the only people that do these sort of spots, because they throw themselves at it. They don't hesitate. They don't take a jump and then like shit out of it. No, they just go for it. And as you said, he doesn't look. He just trusts Blackman enough to know, right, we're in position. Bang.
Aye, no, it's good. It's a spot they still show all the time, countlessly. It's just it's an absolute nuts spot, and it's. I think it kind of lifted the crowd a bit, because we had the three matches that we talked about earlier on. The match before this was the Guerrero one, which was okay, but this helped elevate the crowd even more. The crowd was still hot for all the crap that we'd just seen before it, but I think this took it up an extra level.
Blackman slides down the structure a wee bit to about 20 feet high, which sounds like a disappointment when you realise someone's just fell for 50 feet, but then you're like, no, that's still a human being jumping for 20 feet. Like, he hits a big elbow for the win and picks up the hardcore title. I like how these guys put themselves through hell for a title that basically Blackman could have lost at his hotel room. You know what I mean, like, we talk about WWE not putting emphasis on their titles these days. The hardcore title always get a spotlight. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No, totally. It's a memorable match. You know, as you say, for a title that, you know, can be worthless most of the time. But when they wanted to put an effort on that title on big pay per views, they did, as with those matches I mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I agree with you. So we'll move on to our next match on the card. Chris Benoit versus Chris Jericho, two of the, if not the best technical wrestlers in WWE at that time, bar Kurt Angle. These guys in a 2 out of 3 falls match. I really like the storyline here of, there wasn't, you know, these guys have fought over the European title, the Intercontinental title, you know, they've had ultimate submission matches. This wasn't a case of a title's on the line. This is a case of Jericho and Benoit do not like each other. Jericho and Benoit want to beat the hell out of each other. Jericho and Benoit want to embarrass each other. So they're both going to try and beat each other twice. And again, something that we've not really seen since the Best of 7 series with Cesaro and Sheamus. A storyline built on, I'm the better man and I'm going to prove it.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of Benoit, I mean, it's a shame that we can't look back on a lot of the stuff in Benoit's career in the same light, given, you know, what happened all those years ago now. But anything him and Jericho did, be it facing each other, being as a team, it was like lightning in a bottle. I mean, one of my favourite matches of all time, in a tag team match, it was the one the two of them had as a team against the two-man power trip. Yes. The one where Triple H does his quad, one of my favourite matches of all time. I just love anything they do. I mean, this particular match, it's not even their best match as well. I think they've had better stuff in other matches.
Yeah, it seems sort of rushed. It seems as if obviously they've got other stuff in the card to get to. But, you know, ironically enough, you mentioned we can't really look at Benoit's stuff. There was someone put a clip up on Twitter the other day. It was Benoit in Japan facing Owen Hart. And it was just their sort of chain wrestling and them getting out of each other's holds. And Chris Jericho actually retweeted it, said, if you ever doubted how good these two were, like, you know, watch this. And then just put below it, so good. I think Chris is one of these people, Chris Jericho, he still views Benoit as a great wrestler. But obviously, mm-hmm. he won't glorify what he did.
Mm-hmm. No, totally. And I always remembered Benoit's later time in WWE when he was always the face for most of his time. But he was a really great heel during this whole time in 2000 when he was the Canadian crippler, you know. He just went out there to try and hurt people, you know, by beating them in the ring. And he was great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I think he played the face really well later on when it was the case of, right, we have an annoying face, an annoying heel like Booker T or Orlando Jordan or JBL. Who do we want? You know, good, let's get Benoit because Benoit's going to kick their head in. No, he played that role really well, but, you know, as you said, when he was playing the Canadian Crippler, he was such a dick. He was such a... His goal was to ruin your fun. If anyone's not seen it and is watching current WWE, Shayna Baszler's probably the best comparison I could give him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's spot on. It's a great comparison of it. It's the submission-based style as well.
Mm-hmm. Something I liked about this, and it's something we see a lot in the Attitude Era, the likes of the ankle lock, the walls of Jericho, the crossface, three very well-protected moves. The likes of, you know, Chris Jericho and Benoit would tap out to each other's moves, as they did for the first two falls. Benoit gets a crossface for 1-0. Jericho gets a Walls of Jericho for 1-1. But it seems nowadays the likes of, you know, the Yes Lock is only used for lower card guys. The likes of Del Rio's Cross Arm Breaker, you would never see him win a match against the likes of John Cena or Randy Orton with it. Mm-hmm. But he wins against the likes of Zack Ryder with it. You know what I mean? Submission moves don't seem as protected nowadays, whereas in the Attitude Era, you know, The Rock tapped out to all three of these moves, Stone Cold tapped out of these moves, Triple H tapped out of these moves. It's something that was an art form then.
Mm-hmm. No, it totally was. The crossface can be devastating when he put it on. It was the wrench and the torque he would use on it, the walls mm-hmm. of Jericho, especially when he does it in the Lion Tamer style. Looks painful as anything, you know. It's just, it's just a great. It's amazing though as well. You talk about those two falls, the goal by that. Yet the third fall ends with a roll up. You know, it's just, it's the two sides of things that we got in this match.
I like the story with Benoit not letting Jericho get the break after the first fall, and just going for him. He's right in there. He's beaten into Jericho, and then Jericho just gets a wee flurry of offense, and then the right opening, and gets right into the walls of Jericho. And I think that's why Benoit goes for the roll up in the third fall, because I think he's underestimated Jericho. And he, Benoit, gets caught in a roll up by Jericho. He then reverses it. Go back and watch this match, by the way, because this finish is great. The, how fluid Benoit is, and how quick he is, and how effortless he makes everything look. Benoit gets a roll up on Jericho, grabs the bottom rope, 1, 2, 3, and then uses the bottom rope to drag himself out of the ring as quick as a flash.
It's a lovely, transition onto it. It's very well, it's very fluid. I thought when I first saw the angle, I thought it was one of those ones where they've kind of shoulders are kind of up a wee bit and it just doesn't look great. But no, the shoulders are flush to the mat, flat as anything. It's done so quickly, but yet the two of them pull it off like precisely. You know, it's just a great sign of how good they are. I mean, obviously we see Jericho now still putting on pretty decent matches at his stage of his career. You know, been amazing to have seen what Benoit could have done for another 5-10 years or something like that, given how good he was, if this tragic circumstances have never came about.
Yeah, I think obviously that's from the wrestling side is the biggest tragedy. Obviously, there are bigger tragedies and obviously real life implications. But the fact to get the likes of him versus Punk, you know, we could have got him versus so many people coming about at that time. You know, we never really seen a John Cena feud with Chris Benoit. We never seen, you know, we saw one match for the world title, Randy Orton, Chris Benoit. I would have liked to have seen maybe a Viper, Randy Orton going up against Chris Benoit. Randy Orton, a bit more killer instinct. But obviously, unfortunately, life being what it was, we didn't get that. But this match, it's forgettable when you look at this card because of what's on it. But for me, it's the third best match on the card.
Yeah, it's a solid match, don't get me wrong. It does the job.
That's fair enough, that's all we can really say about it. So we move on next to Kane versus The Undertaker. So this feud came about 2 weeks prior because Kane, who's sort of been in and out, we've not really seen a lot of him on Retro Review. He's on one pay-per-view, then he's off. Then he comes back for two. We last saw him at King of the Ring. That was his first pay-per-view appearance since Insurrection, which was a week after Backlash. He took all of May and part of June off. He then takes July off. We don't see him at Fully Loaded. He returns 2 weeks before SummerSlam. He saved Undertaker from an attack against Chris Benoit and Shane McMahon, and then proceeds to turn heel after turning face 10 seconds earlier because he was healed before he left, and chokeslams The Undertaker through the ring. So this match might seem thrown together, but do you know why it's thrown together, Stephen?
I do not know, but go for it, tell me.
So originally they were working on like a sort of stable. They were going to have Benoit, Edge and Christian, who obviously you saw in the Hardcore title promo package, Helton Shane, and The Big Show, and a sort of stable, a guy who's just worked for Shane McMahon. But then Big Show gets sent back to OVW to lose weight and sort of fix his attitude. And it was meant to be Undertaker Big Show, but unfortunately we didn't get that. So Undertaker was advertised. They didn't want to pull The Undertaker because he was one of the big draws. He had just returned. So they just kind of threw together a Kane versus Big Undertaker match.
You can tell by that one, you know. I mean, we spoke about this privately a couple of days ago, Ross. The amount of times they tried to recreate the Undertaker Kane feud from '98, and the amount of times it fell on its arse. You know, this was not prime Undertaker. This is not WrestleMania 25 versus Shawn Michaels Undertaker. This is an Undertaker who looks absolutely, you know, a shadow of himself a wee bit.
Yeah, he's carrying a lot of extra weight, which is ironic because this is, you know, many people think it's the first time Kane wears the new attire that we'd see him wear till about April 2002. From now until about April 2002, this is Kane's best period, you know what I mean? And he's going up against an Undertaker that's not in his prime, you know what I mean? And then when Undertaker gets to his prime, Kane's sort of past it, you know what I mean? So as you said, whenever they try to recreate it, it just seems to be at the wrong time.
Nah, totally. I mean, it's the match doesn't hold up well in time. You know, 20 years later, it doesn't really hold up very well. I always remembered it as being the Undertaker just trying to take the mask off him. That was always the thing I tried to remember about it. And upon rewatching it, it's the only thing really the match has got. It's the only thing in about it. I'm sure in the Raw, the night afterwards, Undertaker comes out on his bike and he's got the mask on the bike. You know, it's like a trophy. You know, he's took his... But thing about it as well, I remember the point where he takes the mask off and Kane going back up the ramp. I always remember Kane like kind of hiding his face. But see, when you rewatch it, you can clearly see his face. So I don't really know why I was so shocked in 2003 when he actually took his mask off, because he looked the exact same as he did in that after this match in 2000.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We see the promo in the lead up to the match. Kane's asked, "Why did you attack your brother?" And he just yells, "I'm a monster." That to me just leads to more questions.
It's the Kane character is one of the greatest. It's one of the greatest characters of all time, which is baffling consider how really stupid the character arc of Kane is. You know,
yeah.
There's that famous promo where he does in the anger management with Daniel Bryan, where he lists off all those things that he's done, and you're just like, how the hell is this guy going to get in the Hall of Fame? This is absolutely baffling. And obviously, his excuse for attacking his brother's just, "Oh, I'm a monster," you know, when he attacks Undertaker in 2003, it's because Undertaker's no longer a monster, you know, he's now a human. It's like, well, he was a human when you fought him in 2000, it's 3 years on, you know, you've helped him, you know, do so many other things in the years since then.
Something I don't get though, is why do people make Kane out to be the prick when Undertaker's admitted that he's burnt down the family home? You know, and the storyline logic here, Undertaker's the mountain and poor Kane is the hound.
It's wrestling, mate. You know, it's you're meant to like the good guys, but yet they always do the absolute crap thing. It's like in 2012, John Cena smacks the lips on Eve Torres, but yet he's the good guy.
Man, Eve's the hoe.
Exactly. It's like, you're pals with Zach. Don't kiss your mate's mud.
Exactly. Oh, it's just, like, we've talked about so many other things other than the match, because it's technically not even a match. The bell doesn't even ring. They just batter each other about with stairs and chairs. As you mentioned, a lot of the match is just, fight. Is Undertaker trying to get the mask off, and then Kane walks away when Undertaker gets his mask off.
Mm-hmm. It was like a take your mask off match or something like that. I know, it's just it's not the bit. Taker's still trying to get redefine his gimmick at this point in time. I don't think we kind of see him hit his prime in this whole gimmick until probably round about Armageddon with the 6-man Hell in a Cell. But
yeah,
from King of the Ring till there, he was very rough.
Yeah, there's a couple of matches coming up that I'm not looking forward to reviewing. Something else, I think Undertaker doesn't really have a good feud as the American Badass until Triple H, and then doesn't have another good feud until Brock Lesnar. They are the only two good feuds, I think, during the entire American Badass run, because he has so many stupid feuds with like Albert, Test, Rob Van Dam, Maven, you know, the Royal Rumble spot's good, but other than that, there's nothing there.
Well, you're not a fan of his tag team with Nathan Jones.
Moving on. We have tables, ladders, and chairs. Oh my, as Mick Foley would say. It's the first ever tables, ladders, and chairs match for the WWF Tag Team Championship. Edge and Christian, the Hardy Boys, and the Dudley Boys. Just think, Stephen, if it wasn't for these innovators in this match, we wouldn't have seen Kalisto versus Baron Corbin in a chairs match.
That's a really good chairs match. That's the best ever chairs match, actually. I don't know what that says about the other chairs matches, to be fair. No, it is actually a really good chairs match. I talked about this on the best of TLC show that we did on the main feed, where we spoke about this match quite a lot, obviously, as the first ever match in the TLC feud. And it's amazing that the kind of, when you put on a first time ever gimmick match, you need to be innovative with it in order for it to become something that becomes memorable. Otherwise, you end up with a Punjabi prison match as opposed to a TLC match. But these six, I mean, they're such a... People always talk about in the Ruthless Aggression era, they always mention, you get the SmackDown 6, and the SmackDown 6 are always revered. But see, these six guys were in an era, obviously, with Triple H, The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, so they're not seen as high up in the era, but they played just as big a part in making this absolute blockbuster TV as the three guys I mentioned earlier on. It's just the spots they do, it's all so innovative, it's all so creative. It's kind of as if they can trust everything that the other guys are going to do, and it shows in just how fluid the match is. It's an absolute genius match, and it really does stand out like a sore thumb on this card.
Yeah, it's obviously you mentioned these guys, they had their part even though they were in an era with Austin, Kane, Undertaker, Rock, blah blah blah, but I think the best thing here as well, tag wrestling was still appreciated at this time, I think, by WWF. I think now Vince sort of just looks at the teams and goes, who's the big one, who's the big strong guy, who can I, you know, we like the Street Profits, but people are looking at Montez Ford and going, he's a future WWE champion. Like, can we not just leave it, you know, 5 years, 6 years maybe, just let them be a tag team just now, let's have a tag division, and then, you know, later on, like Edge and Christian did, Montez can go off and win a world championship. But I think this is why in the current era the likes of the Revival are so appreciated, even though WWE don't use them, but fans like them for the fact that they want to make tag team wrestling a thing. They want to just be a tag team.
Yeah, I mean, you could spell this whole series between, if you look at this whole feud between these three teams, you can spell it back to the year before in the Terry Runnels Invitational Tournament, where there was that ladder match in No Mercy 1999, which was absolutely fantastic. You got the match between the Hardy Boys and the Dudleys at Royal Rumble 2000, which you spoke about on the first Retro Review. An absolute amazing tag match. People forget about it because it's on the same card as Cactus Jack versus Triple H. You know, there's obviously the match at WrestleMania 2000, which is the ladder match, the best match on that particular card. Maybe the other one that maybe stands out is the Triple Threat with Angle, Benoit, Jericho. It's just it's the way with the feud. As a good feud should do, you kind of step up a bit, you step it up a bit, you step it up a bit, and then you hit the final crescendo, as they would if you to use a musical term. And this TLC match felt like that final, you had to do something big, something better. And the way they kind of combined, it was a genius bit of booking in all ways. And it's amazing that 20 years later, you still hear about a TLC match, and you get quite excited of it. Even the TLC matches that are on the TLC pay-per-view, because you're always quite intrigued at what match is going to get that TLC booking on that card.
No, absolutely, I agree with you there. It's 100 mile an hour from the word go. You know, you see the Hardys, the hometown boys, they get the last entrance. They get an absolutely amazing pop. They charge to the ring, and obviously it's just go for the word, for the first bell, sorry. One spot I loved in particular was Edge setting Bubba up against a ladder. Edge hits the ropes, Bubba moves, and then pulls the ropes so the ladder flies and hits Edge in the face. It just looked like something out of the Three Stooges, but it was just so funny. It was just a sort of slapstick spot.
Ah, yeah, that the Edge and Christian were really good at slapstick stuff. You look at the way when they split up their careers went, they were known more for a lot of different stuff, but back at this point in 2000, there was no better guys for that type of humour than these two. You know, the 5 second pose and all that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something that I liked about this match was this sort of had them arrive, because in the matches from WrestleMania onwards, they have used the titles to either lose by DQ or win when the ref's back is turned. They lost the title for about 2 weeks on SmackDown to Too Cool, only to win them back by cheating again with the titles at King of the Ring. And then this match was sort of a, right, go out there and prove you can do it. There's no DQs, there's no running away. You just have to go out there and win.
And they did that something awful. I always knew there was some big spots in this match. The one with Bubba is always the one that stands out. Matt Hardy takes a really nasty one towards the end. That could have went really badly, that one he takes to kind of take him out of the match.
Yeah, see the, obviously the spot you're talking about with Bubba, he goes towards the entrance ramp and goes through four tables. And obviously that's the one people look at. But yeah, as you mentioned, the Matt Hardy one, because he's so close to the barricade, you're like, oh, that's inches away from a broken neck. That is a sore one. I liked Lita's involvement in this. Shout out to Lita, by the way, because the big complaint we've had on the Retro Review is that Stephanie McMahon is the WWE Women's Champion. She has not defended the title in one match so far. Lita beat her on an episode of Raw, and she has not came out with the belt, and she's not on the card. So we are still waiting for our first Women's Championship match on the Retro Review.
Aye, the spear she takes, that could have ended up nasty, because her head's very close to that ladder.
Yes. So
she's very, very close to actually going back and whacking it. She took some bumps in her time, Lita. You've got to give her a lot of credit for that one. I forgot she was actually involved in this one. I always remember her involvement in TLC 2, along with Spike Dudley and Rhino. But I forgot that she had any sort of involvement in this one until rewatching it.
Yeah, she takes, obviously, a power of punishment. She throws Edge and Christian onto the ropes, groin first, poor boys. And there is one spot in particular that Devon Dudley spoke about. It's when Jeff and him are holding onto the tag belts and the ladder gets taken away from them, and Jeff starts kicking Devon, trying to get him down. Devon Dudley is deathly afraid of heights. And apparently said to Jeff Hardy, "Jeff, if you've ever loved me, for the love of God, stop fucking kicking me."
Jeff has got no fear. That's the kind of difference, you know. Jeff's just like, I don't care, I'll fall, you know, as we see in TLC 2 when he takes the spear while he's hanging.
See, we talk about our very own David Hockney, who's a self-described adrenaline junkie, who
in
says
bed for 9 o'clock.
Yes, he says if he ever had a stag do, he'd like to go do some adrenaline things like bungee jumping. And as someone who's afraid of heights and couldn't do the jump at Escape, I can tell you I will be waiting at the bar at the bottom for you all with a pint in my hand, because I am not going up that bastard thing.
I'd be joining you, don't worry about that.
I think it would be maybe David and like Scott, who's not afraid of heights. Scott loves that sort of thing, so I think it'd just be David and Scott. The rest of you are like, we'll see in the bar, lads. Did you see me? Oh, yeah, I was definitely looking, watching the football on the telly. Of course, Edge and Christian pick up the win, much to the chagrin of the Hardy Boys' hometown. But this was a great match. I don't think you could have complained if anyone won it.
No, 100%. No,
took some amount of punishment.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. It's a fantastic match. And it was topped amazingly at WrestleMania 17, which is crazy.
Exactly, yeah. Like, the sequel is rarely better than the original. And they managed to do that. I think TLC 2, I don't think it's been topped.
No, it's right up there. Best tag match ever.
You know what I might do, actually? Like, I might do maybe a bonus episode of the Retro Review for TLC 3 and 4. Because they're on TV. We might just do a wee blitz special. Just review the both of them in one show.
They're good matches. They just don't stand up compared to the other two.
I think it's because, like, obviously the fourth one has the original three teams in it. Sorry, the third one has the original three teams in it against Jericho and Benoit, but I think just because they're on pay-per-views and they are the first two and they are the innovators, they stand out a lot more.
I love the Raw Roulette one. The Raw Roulette one's amazing.
Yeah. but yeah, Edge and Christian end up winning, and I think this is the best match on the card. So, main event time, we have a triple threat match for the WWF Championship. Not that you would have known it with the promo package. We have The Rock versus Kurt Angle versus Triple H. We saw the promo to open SummerSlam. They like pulling Freddie Blassie out of his box in the Attitude Era for a wee opening promo, don't they?
I always remember when they pulled him out for Invasion and he comes out the wheelchair to give them the prep talk.
Poor guy doesn't even know where he is. He's like May Young.
Aye. Gets up off the chair going, "You will defeat Rhino."
Rhino, who's been in WWE for like the past year and has hardly been in. Rhino, who lost in the King of the Ring semi-finals to Edge, who's not even good enough to get on the Invasion team.
I know. But yeah, Freddie Blassie, what a guy.
We see the whole Angle versus Triple H storyline where Stephanie's in the middle. I was really looking forward to after King of the Ring, when The Rock pins Vince McMahon and Vince is off TV, to it not being all about the McMahons. And then what do we have? We have Stephanie sending Triple H after Chris Jericho, and we have Shane McMahon managing Chris Benoit to get revenge on The Rock because he wants someone to take the title from The Rock. Like, people complain about McMahon's all over the product now. This was happening 20 years ago, and it was as exhausting then as it is now.
You got to admit, this is as much as they've tried to pull off these kind of romance angles, this is one of the best ones of all time with Kurt Angle, Triple H, and Stephanie. I know you might not like it as a Rock fan, and The Rock being the odd one out in this whole thing, and he's just there. He's like, it was like David Hockney before he got his girlfriend. You know, he was just that guy that was there. You know, but I thought
you can smell what the hawk is cooking.
I loved it. This was the first time I really enjoyed Kurt Angle as a character. I thought he was absolutely brilliant the way he did it. I loved the bit backstage where he phones Stephanie, and she's up she's with Triple H, and she's like, "Hi, Mum." "Oh no, I can't talk to her." He's like, "Can I talk to your mum?" She hung up on me.
Linda's always thought you were an asshole hunter.
No, but it's it builds and builds and builds.
Yeah. So, did you know the story was going to be Stephanie would leave Triple H for Kurt Angle, but then the story was scrapped as Stephanie took over creative a month later?
And then he wanted to be with Kurt.
She was sort of the head of creative after this.
And then he wanted to be with Kurt then. Shame.
Basically, something that Gerald Briscoe apparently pulled Triple H up for. Triple H was given it the, "Well, look at me," because obviously he's the big built Greek god. "Look at me and look at Kurt Angle," and Briscoe apparently said to him, "Yeah, but in a real life fight, Kurt Angle would kick your ass."
Oh, this was the point where you couldn't really believe that Kurt Angle could kick your ass because you only saw that character. But obviously, as the years went on, when he became the wrestling machine, Kurt Angle, you thought he would beat me every blooming neck of the woods. But I actually think the match is actually really good, considering all the things that go with it. The build to it, the hot start's great. The best part of the match for me is before The Rock even gets out there. That's just so heated.
Yeah, I like I like Kurt Angle's arrogant heel promo, where this is when we start to see a bit of personality. It's not just the three eyes and the deluded Olympic hero who thinks he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. He goes, "I will not apologise, Triple H, for giving your wife the passion you never could." And you just hear it, like Jerry Lawler always like cheered, like was always singing the praises of Kurt Angle. And you just hear both Lawler and Triple H going, sorry, Lawler and JR going, oh yeah, Kurt, I wouldn't have done that. That's not. And it's as soon as he says, I gave your wife the passion, Triple H's music hits and he just storms to the ring.
Mm-hmm. And then gives him the most brutal, unintentionally brutal, in a way, table spot that's ever happened.
Yeah, poor Kurt gets concussed 2 minutes in as Triple H sets up for a pedigree and the table just it comes away.
I've always wondered if all the stuff they do after the later on the match was planned or if they did it on the fly. Because if they did it on the fly, it's creative. But otherwise, it's you know, he was always going to go through the table anyway. So,
yeah. Kurt's actually said in an interview that it took three people to get him through the match. The Rock had to put him through it. Triple H had to keep him. And Stephanie was on the outside, like, basically tapping him, saying, go now. Like, telling him when to break it. Because you see, later on in the match, Triple H hits Rock with a pedigree. And he sort of just looks back and feeds his leg to Kurt. And you can actually hear Stephanie going, break up the pin.
It's some bump, you know. It's he gets an absolute walloping to the point they actually got him sat up on the chair. I think actually Triple H says to the ref, you can kind of see him trying to say something to the ref, which obviously is him saying he's buggered, you know, and he sends somebody back here.
Yeah, I'd like to. I thought they maybe had another 5 minutes in them. And you could have maybe cut backstage to The Rock just sort of waiting with the belt. And then maybe just sit. Because The Rock's music sort of hits out of nowhere.
They've obviously sent The Rock out there. Go now.
The crowd go absolutely wild as soon as The Rock's music hit. You see the crowd who are all like pushed forward to one side of the barricade so they can see what's going on, run up to the entrance ramp. The crowd just moves in a massive herd and it's unreal to watch.
Mm-hmm. That's good. It's peak attitude there. This is The Rock's peak, I think, as a popular babyface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's number one babyface at the minute because Austin is out. And to be honest, I think, see when Stone Cold comes back, I don't think he recaptures the magic. You know, he's...
No, he never does hit that level again.
No, whereas Rock, I think, just goes from strength to strength. And because The Rock had been heel and face throughout this era, he was able to turn back and forward without any consequence. Whereas obviously later on when Austin sides with McMahon, it kind of just ruins it.
Mm-hmm. No, totally. But no, I think that this is peak Rock, you know. And the three of them do put, given the circumstances, there's so much entertainment in this match. The bit with Triple H pulling the trying to pull Angle back down in the ring on the stretcher is absolutely amazing.
I like how five guys couldn't stop Triple H dragging this stretcher.
I know. It's like he wasn't even the boss's son at that the boss's son-in-law at that point in time. It's like oops away you.
We had a Triple H accidentally hitting Stephanie as well. We had a Angle getting thrown at the ring by The Rock. We had just so many fun spots in this match, as you said. Just there's so many miscues. You know, Stephanie goes to hit The Rock with the title because Triple H tries to send her back, and basically, when she won't go, he goes, "Right, well, make yourself useful. Get the belt." And she goes to hit The Rock with the belt, and Rock ducks, and she hits Triple H.
I think they could have had a lot of mileage with these two, having something more tease between these two splitting up, as opposed to what we get later on, you know. They could have done better with it post this pay-per-view. I'm not going to spoil too much for your next shows, Ross. Yeah. But they could have done a lot more with it. So they could have done a lot more with it, because I think there was a lot of mileage to these two, Kurt Angle and Triple H feud.
Yeah, it's unfortunate as well, because we see them sort of in the... They have a pre-WrestleMania sort of feud before WrestleMania 18, and then they sort of get split up with the brand split, and they never really come together again until obviously WrestleMania 34 and the mixed tag match with Ronda Rousey.
Mm-hmm. Aye, That's actually a really good point, actually. I didn't really actually think about that. And Kurt didn't have the same mobility then as he did back then.
Yeah, obviously he'd been through the ringer a bit.
Just a bit.
Rock takes advantage of all the miscues and people getting in each other's way. Triple H knocks down Stephanie. Rock takes out Angle. And then Triple H walks straight into a people's elbow. Rock gets the three for the win. Crowd go wild. And obviously we see this feud sort of continue over into Unforgiven as The Rock sort of just takes his title from there. He's sort of done with these two in the title picture. These two are going to go their own way and sort of have a personal feud over Stephanie.
Mm-hmm. The biggest prize in all of wrestling. Stephanie McMahon, Hemsley.
Winner becomes CEO and gets to found NXT.
The other one goes to TNA.
I'm sure that was a stipulation. I'll look it up later, you know, before I do the show with Strack.
it sounded a bit right.
But that is going to do us here on the Retro Review. That was SummerSlam. Just before we go, Stephen, what would you say, other than TLC and maybe the main event, because they were the two matches that really stuck out, what would you go for your match or the moment of the night?
It's got to be Terry versus the Cat. No, I'm joking. I would go with Blackman and Shane in that spot at the end.
Yeah, I think for something that gets shown 20 years later, even though Shane McMahon's dived off a Hell in a Cell twice, it's something that's got to be taken in. I agree with you. Shane versus Blackman. Shout out obviously to Triple H and The Rock for the simple fact after Kurt Angle gets concussed, these two, despite fighting for the majority of 2000, managed to put on a fresh and enjoyable match as well.
That's why they're the best, two of the best.
Exactly. So you can follow us, Suplex Retweet Extra and Eat Sleep Suplex Retweet on Anchor, iTunes, Spotify and all Android podcasting sites, at Suplex Retweet, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube. Eat Sleep Suplex Retweet Community on Facebook. SuplexRetweet.com is our shiny website. It's not new anymore, but it's still shiny. And that's really all we have to plug, isn't it?
Yeah, there's not really much going on.
Quarantine, yes. So, thank you again, Stephen.
Thanks, Ross. Pleasure.
Thank you. I've been Ross McLeod saying, stay inside.